This episode of the Hill Country Podcast, I visit with Dr. Dawn Frazier, who is the head of the Texas Center at Shriner University. We talk about the Texas Center, talk a whole lot about Texas history, what it means, and why the Texas Center is one of the leading academic institutions for the study of Texas history.
The Texas Hill Country is one of the most beautiful places on earth. In this podcast, recent Hill Country resident Tom Fox visits with the people and organizations that make this one of the most unique areas of Texas. Join Tom as he explores the people, places, and their activities of the Texas Hill Country.
The Hill Country Podcast, and man, you are in for a treat today because I have with me Dawn Frazier. Dawn is the director of the Texas Center at Shriner University. He is an extraordinarily well-published author around Texas history, and we're going to talk about all things Texas Center and Texas history. So, Dawn, first of all, welcome, and thank you so much for taking the time to visit with me today.
Oh, I'm happy to be here and happy for the opportunity. This is always fun for me.
Dawn, could you tell us a little bit about your academic background?
So my academic background, I'm an unlikely academic. So my background was actually in journalism, and I worked in the defense industry for a while, and decided that, you know what, that was just not turning my crank. And ended up going to TCU, going into graduate school there, and ended up with a PhD from there, worked with Grady McWhinney, and graduated in 1992, taught at TCU for a year. Then I was in Abilene for 26 years, teaching at a school called McMurray. And then Shriner recruited me to come down here and start the Texas Center. And I thought, you know, that would be a great way to sort of cap off a career. So here I am.
So what was your dissertation on back when you got your PhD?
All right. So I was always interested in Texas and the Civil War, because growing up, you know, essentially all the literature said Texas really didn't do much in the Civil War. And I found that to be a little unsatisfying, because I was seeing lots of evidence that, in fact, it had an impact on Texas. And so my dissertation topic was on the Confederate invasion of New Mexico. And imagine my surprise that there was a Civil War campaign not only in Texas but also into New Mexico. But that was not my first choice. So the way I ended up in the history business is I was a kid living in Macon, Georgia. Now, native of Texas, lived in Macon for a couple of years. And while I was there, I discovered a number of graves of Texas Confederates in a cemetery there in Macon. And it struck me that these guys were dead a long way from home. And I thought, there's bound to be a story there. So I'm in sixth grade. I go and ask my dad, you know, what do I do with this information from their tombstone? And he gave me the rudiments of research. And from that point on, I essentially tried to rebuild these guys' lives from the grave backwards. And so they were all in an outfit in the Civil War called Granberry's Brigade, Hiram Granberry. Town of Granberry is named after him. They were in Cleburne's division. So Cleburne's named after their division commander. A lot of Texas fingerprints and Confederate fingerprints in this story. And when I went to TCU, I'd had a kind of a mediocre day at the defense industry. I exited University Drive in Fort Worth and thought, man, I bet there's a university at the end of this drive. Turned out there was. And that's where I met Grady McWhinney. And I said, I'd like to ride on Granberry's Brigade, since I'd been thinking about it for a big chunk of my life. And he said, nope, you can't. There's somebody already working on that. So I had to come up with plan B right there on the spot. And I said, I would like to write about Tom Green. And he said, Tom Green, I've heard of him, Tom Green County. Great, why don't you write about him? And that's what led me into a study of the Texas Revolution, and then all the way through the New Mexico campaign, and then several books on the Louisiana campaigns. He's the central theme to most of my scholarship.
So if there are any Civil War aficionados listening to this podcast and they think of Texas's role other than John Bell Hood, they may have heard of the Battle of Sabine Pass.
Correct.
But that's about it. Many years ago, when I was a trial lawyer, I had a fascinating case involving the estate of Mifflin Kennedy.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I learned about the Civil War in very South Texas, particularly around smuggling across the Mexican border at Rio Grande into Texas and the flagging of riverboats. But that's a story for another day. Obviously, we can talk about this forever, so we're not going to go down those rabbit holes yet. But what's your current role?
All right, so my current role is I'm the director of the Texas Center. And I had been just a classroom professor doing all that sort of classroom professor stuff. And Charlie McCormick here at Shriner said, no, you need to come down here to Kerrville. Now, at the time he was asking this, this is probably about 6 years ago. Well, longer than that now. I had children in school. And I wasn't going to yank them out of their nice, safe, you know, school experience and bring them down here where they would be anonymous at a very vulnerable time. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. He said, well, fine. What I really want you to do for starters is build a Texas Studies minor. And you can do that up in Abilene. So I actually built out an online course of study called Texas Studies. So you can go be an accounting major, you can go be an art major, but the Texas Studies minor is essentially a way to get familiar with this huge place. I mean, Texas is as large as Germany. And so I started doing video presentations, no more than about 15 minutes. Ended up with 600 of them that gives the entire scope of Texas history. There's actually a number of courses that compose those 600, or the 600 videos compose. And that's how I began my relationship with Shriner. Then one day, my kids were out of school, and I ran out of excuses. So I came down and we decided we'd put this deal together. And the idea was that Shriner was going to be the university on the face of the planet that was going to fully embrace its Texas identity. You know, if you go to a lot of universities, they're very, very keen on taking their students and saying, you need to learn the wonders of being a global citizen, which is all good and it's all valid and you need to know stuff about the rest of the world. The reality that most people that go to school, especially in Texas, are looking at is they're probably going to spend a life in Texas. And if they're going to spend a life in Texas, then we probably ought to prepare them for that life, prepare them for things that are going to come at them during their course of their lives, their careers in Texas, and essentially be the guys that create the next generation of leaders in the state. So the way the university expressed it, the way Shriner expressed it, was that they wanted to be uniquely Texan, and they needed to find a unique Texan. And I think that for the first time in my academic career, my accent probably proved to be an asset instead of a sign of curiosity. So that's what brought me down here.
So after you got down here, how did you build out the Texas Center?
Okay, so we brought with us when we came down all of the assets of a nonprofit that we had started back in 95, the McWinney Group. So I mentioned Grady McWinney was my major professor at TCU. He died without heir, and he was an only child, married to an only child, and next thing you know, he had a library that needed to be disposed of. He had, a modest estate in terms of liquidity goes. And he just needed somebody to carry on that legacy, his research interest. So we put together a nonprofit, and in the course from 95 to his passing in 2006, accumulated books and art and all sorts of other things. We started a publishing company. We started a historical travel enterprise, and all of that was the McWinney Group. So when I came to Kerrville, I brought that with me, and I told the guys at Shriner, I said, look, you know, Texas Center needs to have a little bit of space. And they said, great, here's 800 square feet over here. And I said, no, I think you're going to have to get a little more than that. And so they ended up giving me the Guy Griggs building. And as you can see from walking around, we have filled it. We have filled it with books and art and artifacts and offices and all sorts of things like that. So it was essentially, when I joined this new tribe, I wanted to bring in my own string of ponies. and that's kind of what I did.
So let's just keep on that metaphor then. You've grown that string of ponies.
I have.
And can you tell us about how you grew out the Texas Center, and maybe what are two or three of your projects you have ongoing now?
Sure. I mean, when you start, this is a startup. This is an academic startup, and most academics are not known for their entrepreneurial skills. But I came in and said, look, this is going to be like any business startup. We got to have operating capital. And the school's like, you know, we've got some we can throw in, but you're kind of catching us, at the beginning of a pandemic. I mean, my first day on the payroll here at Shriner was the 1st of June 2020. You know, if you can go back in your Wayback Machine, that was kind of the height of it all. And so that was one of the challenges. So I said, in order to get operating capital, what I'm going to do is build a group of supporters that I called the Old 300. So these are going to be the founders, and I'm just ripping off Stephen F. Austin on that, because what he did is he went out to find 300 families that would come to Texas and support his idea of how to develop what was wilderness into a productive part of the world. So I said, you know, I like that, and I like that image. So I started asking people to throw in, you know, modest operational gifts, and let's see how many people would answer the call. And so far I've had 133 families from around the state throw in. That means I've got, you know, a little ways to go to get to 300, but I'm pretty happy with the progress. And that's led to a couple of institutional donors, some foundations that said, wow, this must be a real thing. And so all of a sudden they started throwing in, and we've accumulated a decent start, and now we're going to start pivoting towards an endowment piece so that we can perpetuate that. But that's how startups happen. You know, you have to have short money and long money, and we've got the short money underway, and we're going to start looking at long money after this.
So let me turn to your scholarship.
Sure.
Because in preparing a little bit for this podcast, I discovered I knew you, and I knew you through your scholarship.
Oh, nice.
And the invasion of New Mexico.
Yeah.
Because when that came out, I'd frankly never heard of that.
Yeah.
And I thought I was pretty well versed in Texas history. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your scholarship? Because I tried to count the number of books you've written, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. So how many books have you written, and what might you have that you're working on now?
Sure. So I've got 7 books that I'm the sole author on, but and some that I've had a chunk of. So it just depends on how you want to count it. But my scholarship is really focused on the middle period of the 19th century, and that includes everything from the Republic of Texas, the Texas Revolution, the founding of Texas, all the way through the end of the Civil War, and then the frontier beyond that. So I'm really a 19th century guy, which is the heroic age in Texas history. So the Blood and Treasure, my book about the New Mexico campaign, kind of launched it all. And when I'd gone to graduate school, I figured I'd just do a muster in to muster out history of that brigade. But it turns out they were involved in a lot of stuff that just there wasn't any books on. There was no scholarship on it. All of a sudden, I was looking at having to clear the forest, grub the stumps, and plow the ground. And so that's what I've been doing for the most of my career. So Blood and Treasure started it off. Then I did a project called The U.S. and Mexico at War, which is a big research anthology. 1 out of 4 contributors. I had about 120 contributors. A quarter of them were from Mexico. Now, this is before the internet. This is before email. So we're doing all this via fax, and I'm reading Spanish language facsimiles with contributions. It was a big, complicated project for Macmillan, but it ended up being a real landmark book. That I'm extraordinarily proud of that book, because it was difficult to do. But it's got a 75-year shelf life at least, so that was a cool one. Then I went over into the Louisiana campaigns. So the troops that invaded New Mexico come back, they're shot up, beat up, tore up. But then they get rebuilt, refreshed, renewed, and they throw into the campaigns in Louisiana. And again, I'm going campaigns in Louisiana, I thought that's pretty easy. Fall of New Orleans, Red River campaign, and that's the bookends. Turns out Louisiana is an extraordinarily complicated theater of war, and extraordinarily complicated when it comes to understanding real impact of the American Civil War on this nation. And it's interesting when you look at the war from Louisiana looking northeast towards Virginia, as opposed to Virginia looking southwest towards the rest of this, because it's a whole different story. I mean, it's a completely, it plays out in so many interesting and unique ways. So that led to books, Fire in the Cane Field, Thunder Across the Swamp, Blood on the Bayou, and then Tempest Over Texas. Well, I thought I could tell the story in four books. Turns out I probably need a fifth one. And the folks over in Louisiana said, look, you're the guy to write a new book on the Red River Campaign. And I'm like, you know, there's already about 12 books on that topic. You know, I just don't want to lay another one on top of the pile. And they said, well, the difference is you have studied this from the very beginning. I mean, you know all the players, you know where they came from, you know all these regiments, the armies, the personalities, the overall strategy better than anybody on the planet. So now you got to kind of finish it out. And so that's in the back of my mind right now, is that Red River Campaign and the end of the Civil War. But Civil War has a huge impact on the development of Texas. I mean, an outsized influence, in fact. The Texas that you know and recognize today is largely a product of the Civil War, because everybody moved here after the Civil War. So in many ways, Texas gets this infusion of folks from Tennessee and South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, the torn up, burned up South, and they come to Texas to rebuild. And they bring with them a certain suite of attitudes and capabilities that take Texas from still being kind of a howling wilderness and turn it into one of America's heartlands.
What I learned from my study of Mifflin Kennedy was he and Richard King were smugglers.
Oh, absolutely.
During the Civil War, and they made their fortunes running guns up the Red River. Mifflin Kennedy had a family. His first family was a Mexican. He married a Mexican national. Yeah. So he had sons who could speak Spanish fluently and looked like they were from Mexico. And then he and Captain King went their separate ways with huge ranches of 400,000 and 800,000 acres, I think. And it turned out that after they developed those ranches, they happened to sit on a sea of oil.
Yeah.
And so it brings us literally right up to today. The other thing, though, is the perspective you articulated, not Washington or Virginia looking south and west, but Louisiana and Texas looking north and east. And the other thing about the Louisiana campaign that's always intrigued me was, beyond the military, was the political and even economic impact.
Oh,
because
huge.
A lot of things were tried, certainly we could even start with Benjamin Butler, that later were tried in other areas and then actually became policy after the war. So I was always fascinated with Louisiana as really, at that point, a kind of a hotbed or a laboratory for different types of experimentation. And that perspective of looking northeast is, I think, one that's absolutely needed.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you're trying to change the historiography, you know, the study of history on the Civil War, because the Virginians don't want to hear it. You know, it's all about Bobby Lee, and it's all about the Army of the Potomac. And, you know, that's kind of the beginning and end for them. I actually had a conversation with a very prestigious Civil War historian. And I said, you know, tell me your take on the Civil War and kind of what it's all about. And he says, well, that's pretty easy. You just remember Washington and Richmond. And if you can remember those two towns, you understand the Civil War. And I said, well, yeah, I'm doing a lot of work out there in the Trans-Mississippi, so what was all that about? And he goes, oh, that was just needless violence. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, the guys that were wrapped up in it sure thought it mattered. But Louisiana is actually the laboratory for how you transition people from enslaved to free. And that's critical, because all of a sudden these people have to find their place as citizens. And they're not equipped. I mean, they're not literate. They have no tradition of making their own decisions, things like that. So how do you turn them into people that can be full participants in the American system of government? And it's a challenge, an absolute challenge. But first, you got to meet their basic needs, food, clothing, shelter. And if you've taken them away from the plantation and that's all they know, how do you see to their needs? number of ways. They conscripted them into the army. So you free them, and then you put a gun in their hands and say, great, now you can stop a bullet too. Congratulations. The women and children sometimes were segregated out into camps and then essentially put on the government payroll in some nature. During the course of the war, a lot of the plantations are seized by federal authorities and then leased out to people that are coming down from up north. And they need labor, so they say, all right, great, we got this pool of labor, you can hire them. And so what these new plantation owners did is say, fine, we'll pay you $15 a month, but the rent on your house is going to be $14 a month. You know, so I'm not sure that their situation improved a whole heck of a lot. But it was in fits and starts on how you absorb this newly emancipated population in the middle of a war, in the middle of some Confederates that are trying to thwart federal policy, in the middle of the political comings and goings of trying to readmit states into the Union. Yeah, it's a real basket case. And there's probably a reason nobody wrote the books I wrote, because it's a complicated story. But once I fell into it, I said, well, I got to see it to the end.
So I grew up in Texas. Yeah. I fell in love with Texas history about the same age as you were, fifth and sixth grade. And then I go to seventh grade, and they're teaching Texas history in what was then called junior high school. And that cemented it for me.
Yeah.
Why is the teaching of Texas history in Texas K through 12 so important in your opinion?
Because you need to know what you're inheriting. So, I mean, we teach American history because we're inheriting the American experience. In my opinion, Texas is perhaps the best expression of the American idea. And I really, when I tell people this, they kind of furrow their brow because they say, well, Texans see themselves as, you know, some sort of different creature. And I said, no. I think you may be missing something. In 1776, there was a bunch of smart guys that gathered in Philadelphia. They took a lot of political philosophy that was 100 or 200 years old, some classical allusions from Republican Rome, and they came up with an experiment called the United States. At that point, it's just a theory, because they're trying to make sense out of separating from an empire and turning colonies into states. But what do those theories look like beyond that? You know, how do they actualize in the field? And Texas is really the big experiment, the big application of this American ideal in a completely new context, in a foreign country, as it turns out. You know, one of the things that the Mexican authorities were concerned about with Americans coming into Texas by invitation, and illegally, there was a big illegal immigration problem that the government of Mexico was facing. They were concerned that the people coming in were just not going to make good Mexicans. And so they sent an inspector up to Texas to take a look around, and he came back and said, look, I can tell you that there's ugly ones and pretty ones and rich ones and poor ones and honest ones and dishonest ones. But every one of those Americans is carrying their Constitution in their pocket. So all of a sudden you have the export of the American idea into Texas. And pretty soon, as Mexico was heading towards despotism, they found out that despotism and everybody carrying their Constitution in their pocket was at odds. You know, they were mutually exclusive. So I think that it's important to pass that story on to the next generation, the current generation, for Pete's sake. And one of the things that's happening in the state of Texas is that it is about to double its population by 2050. So these people are coming from other states in the Union, in the United States, but they're also coming from South Asia, they're coming from South America, they're coming from all over the world. And each of these immigrant groups need to find their place in the Texas story. So it behooves us to continue telling that Texas story. If you quit telling it, it's lost in a generation. And there's been a lot of erosion in the sort of semester space, the classroom space that Texas history has been given. My daughters, for instance, didn't get a full year of Texas history. They got a semester, and it was taught by people that were close to retirement and who were not versed in Texas history. They were good at worksheets and things like that. And then the second semester was about learning how to operate Microsoft Word and Microsoft Office, because that's also a dictate, a requirement in junior high. So, you know, you're looking around, where do we put this new computer literacy requirement? Well, we don't really test over Texas history, so we'll just carve it in there. And so I have seen a steady erosion of this study of Texas history, and that's a concern. So that's one of the projects that we're actually working on here at the Texas Center, is coming up with a K through 16 approach to studying Texas and making those national and international connections between the Texas experience and the overall story of humanity.
So I'd plan to ask you a question about why the future of the Texas Center. I think you've answered that. But you also talked about the groups coming into Texas. And yeah, certainly it's internal migration,
sure,
from the north, but a wide variety of international folks coming, obviously across the southern border, but you specifically mentioned South Asians. We have a huge Vietnamese community.
Yeah, we wouldn't be eating fresh shrimp in this state if it wasn't for a bunch of the Vietnamese community. So
Chinese, we have a lot of South Asians, Indian nationals.
We wouldn't have doctors in rural Texas if it wasn't for Indian nationals, yeah.
And for those folks to understand kind of where the state came from and their role in taking us forward seems to me to be as important as any other type of endeavor.
It is indeed. And so you've got to grab the story and build consensus. And the story we tell at the Texas Center is an optimistic story. And is the history of Texas perfect? Heavens no. I mean, it's populated by human beings and we're all broken pieces of creation. So it is not always a happy tale, but the general trend line is optimistic and positive. And so you're right. If you're coming in from, say, Shanghai, you've got to figure out how your experience up to that point prepares you or doesn't prepare you for life in Texas. And what I find is that a bunch of folks that come from overseas are rather bewildered but excited by this Texas story. So we try to be optimistic. We understand that we need to do an honest telling, and I think that being honest about the past, which informs the present, will help us prepare for the future. And so everybody's got their sort of piece of the song. You know, Texas has always been a place of immigrants. It always has been. I mean, I've studied the Civil War at the granular level, and I can tell you that there was darn few Texans in those Texas regiments by Texas natives. I mean, they're coming from Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee and elsewhere. Well, that's no different. You know, a lot of people say, "Ah, man, don't California my Texas." You know, that's bumper stickers I've seen. Well, most of the Californians I've met have come in as political refugees. You know, they can't really find their place in California anymore. They've been edged out by the large metropolitan centers, and these guys are probably interior Californians or suburban Californians, and all of a sudden they feel like they're just kind of in a cattle cart on a train that they can't really control, so they're jumping off and coming here. And these Californians are bringing imagination and capital, which are two things that help develop places like Texas. But they don't quite understand the secret sauce that Texas brings. Something attracted them. You know, one very well-heeled entrepreneur said it's the three F's, faith, family, and freedom, that attracted them to Texas. But they always seem to be missing that sort of next step. You know, why do you guys almost seem like you're a nation within a nation? And so that's part of what I see our mission is here at the Texas Center, is to kind of give them a newcomer's guide to the state, you know, help them integrate in. Because I like the energy they bring. I like the imagination. I mean, it wasn't a Texan that was developing an independent space company until you finally get, you know, what is Bezos a Texan? Is he not a Texan? But it looks like Elon Musk is moving his whole operation here down to Boca Chica. Bezos is still launching from out in West Texas. So all of a sudden, Texas is going to lead the way into space, too. And I don't think that's an accident. There is an atmosphere and a culture here that encourages innovation. And a lot of times that innovation comes from immigrants.
Well, Don, unfortunately, we're near the end of our time for this podcast, but I was wondering if our listeners wanted any more information on the Texas Center or perhaps more information on some of the topics we've touched on, where could they go?
All right. First of all, you can drop me an email any old time. So that's pretty simple. It's dsfrazier@schreiner.edu. But you can find that email address on the Texas Center website here at the university. It's kind of a placeholder website at this point, but you know, watch this space, because we're going to start putting Texas content up, a lot of video features that are coming up, and we'll talk about what's going on all over the state. As much as anything, the Texas Center is an amplifier of the cool stuff that's going on around the state. So come in, establish a relationship with us, join our mailing list, and we'll keep you in the loop.
Well, Don, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit with me. I can only ask that I hope we can continue this conversation.
Well, you know your way to the Texas Center, so anytime.
This is Tom Fox again. We're going to link to the Texas Center at Schreiner University in the show notes. I hope you will check it out. It really is one of the finest academic institutions for Texas history I've come across, and they have a large memorabilia collection as well. I hope you will join me for another episode of the Hill Country Podcast, where I continue to explore the people, places, and things which makes this part of Texas one of the most unique. Thanks again. If you're a resident of the Hill Country and would like to tell your story, please give me a shout at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. The Hill Country Podcast is a production of the Compliance Podcast Network.